Well, I'm here with Dr. Zach Eswine today. Zach, thanks for making time to talk to me about your book.
Thanks, Jackson. It's good to be with you.
Can you maybe tell us a little bit, just for people who are going to be listening to this or reading this who maybe have never heard your name, tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do presently.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm a pastor in Webster Groves, Missouri, Riverside Church. I've been here 8 years. I also serve as director of homiletics for a seminary down the road, Covenant Seminary. And so I've been in pastoral ministry over 20 years. And I'm a husband and a father and just doing local life here.
Yeah, great, great. Well, part of what drew your name to my attention, I was aware of a few of your books from previous years, but I came across this book in particular, The Imperfect Pastor. And it's been received very positively. In fact, it was an award winner with Christianity Today in the, I think it's Church Life and Pastoral Leadership mm-hmm. category.
Yeah.
Has the reception of the book surprised you at all?
Yeah. Yeah, it has. Yes.
Yeah, to put it in a word.
Yeah, you know, it's written in a more poetic or autobiographical way, so I wasn't sure how that'd be received, and seeking to put pastoral theology into that kind of format was a little different, so I didn't know if that would resonate with folks in its style, and then the content itself is, I guess, pushing back on some of the things that we assume is normative for pastoral life, so I didn't know if that would, how that'd be received either. So yeah, I am surprised pleasantly.
I have to go ahead and insert this at this point. I have to say the book was difficult to read for precisely the two reasons you just named.
Yeah.
It's written in a different manner than most ecclesiology, pastoral leadership books. It demands a little bit more of the reader, I think, which isn't bad. I think we probably need that. It's also a strength of the book, ironically, I believe. But also, as you said, it touches on some important assumptions and challenges, many of them, in fact. And so in that way, the book was very difficult to read. And yet, I mean, I'm gratified, as I'm sure you are, that it has been received mm-hmm. as well as it has.
Yep. Yeah, I am. Yeah, if someone's looking for the three bullet points of steps of what to do, this book will drive them crazy. to try to embody what pastoral vocation feels like, sounds like, tastes like, you know, to try to get a sense of that is what I was trying to accomplish.
Mm. Well, as we think about influences that contributed to this book, and of course other things in your life, you do mention in the book a pastor friend who several years ago took his life,
mm-hmm.
and that had a great ripple effect, it seems like, on a lot of mm-hmm. Your peers and colleagues mm-hmm. and friends and yourself as well.
Yep.
Can you say just a word about how that played into the vision behind this book and maybe other things that you've written?
Yeah, my friend would have been, he was the pastor that I would highlight for students, you know, as I was teaching at a seminary. He's one of those kinds of pastors. He was also, he was what any young person kind of aspires to in ministry. You know, he was in his second pastorate, his first pastorate. He'd been there for many, many years, dearly loved, saturated in a community, a college town, people like me, coming to know the Lord, and then he was in the midst of a building program at the church. The church that he was at was growing dramatically in size. They were building a new building, building a gymnasium, you know, things like this. He was sought after to speak at various events, or people like young people like myself looking to him for counsel. He was successful, and but internally, there was a great deal going on. And I think, that, you know, the thing that struck me is that, you know, I think any of us who knew him and loved him, we would have just preferred him to step down. from his title, you know, his position, and be the limited man that he actually was. And he still would have blessed us so much. You know, we could have just gone and had coffee or tea and learn. You know, he didn't have to be. I think that's the thing that struck me. Did he know, you know? I look back, did he know that he didn't have to? Did he know he could have stepped down? He would have still been somebody. He would have still ministered to us. He would have still had a role to play, even with the limits and weaknesses of where his mind had gone and his emotional fatigue had led him, you know. So that has had that triggered a great deal of thought and reflection on what is success, what is a great thing, what does it mean to achieve, what really matters anyway in ministry. Is it possible even in ministry to gain the whole world and yet be in danger of losing our souls, you know? So I don't know, just cause questions like that to live with.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, the subtitle of the book, it's so apt. And let me share that. It's Discovering Joy in Our Limitations Through a Daily Apprenticeship with Jesus. And I pay a lot of attention to subtitles. I don't know if the average person does, but it's so apt. And in fact, I think, in a sense, you summarize what you mean by that on page 35, and I'll, for the benefit of the listener, I'll share that. You say, I believe that Christian life and ministry are an apprenticeship with Jesus toward recovering our humanity and, through His Spirit, helping our neighbors do the same. We'll talk in a moment a little bit more about this idea of limits, but say a word or two, if you would, about this language of apprenticeship with Jesus. It's in the subtitle of the book, and I've heard you use it in other contexts, I think, as well. Say a word about that in the context of church leadership literature, especially.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we're usually using the word discipleship, to be a disciple, a follower, a learner, a student with Jesus. I chose apprenticeship because it's synonymous, you know, similar in meaning, but also on purpose, because for many of us, discipleship has gradually become equated with the passing on of content, you know, meeting for coffee together, reading through a workbook or something like that, completing that workbook. And that is discipleship, and there's a lot of good fruit that comes from that. But the kind of discipleship that the disciples had was a full-bodied apprenticeship, like in the old days when, if you wanted to learn how to be a blacksmith, you would apprentice with a blacksmith, so you'd learn his ways of being in the world and in his vocation. And so trying to capture this idea that in life and ministry, we're really seeking not just a content, it's not less than that, but not just a content that we're passing on, but also a way of being that accompanies that content. And so one way to think of it, I have, you know, I talk about my mamaw, my grandmother, and I try to make mamaw's macaroni, that's what we call it, you know. And I have her recipe written down, and many people have this experience. You know, I just can't make it quite the way she did, even though I'm following the directions. And it causes me to wish I would have just hung around more while she made the meal, because there's something not on the directions that she's doing that I don't have access to. And so we learn, you know, we're discipled, we're apprenticed, not only by the content, but by the ways of being. Ways teach as well as words, and the disciples had that experience with Jesus.
Well, we'll kind of come back to that a little bit more in a moment, because all these themes that we're discussing seem to dovetail, at least as I read the book. One of the big themes in the book, a pervasive theme, I thought, was that of ambition, and even what you might call significance, a sense of significance. And I'm actually preparing to preach one of the passages this Sunday on when the disciples are arguing about who's the greatest. Mm-hmm. And so this has been on my mind a lot. I want to read two small excerpts from the book, one on page 145 and then one on 158, which illustrate this, and then have you comment. You say that I have prayers to say for persons you've never heard of. Mm-hmm. And then later, on page 158, you say this about pastoral work. I didn't realize then that a pastor's vocation with prayer and word and care is many times invisible, tucked away with Jesus in one-on-one or small group moments, hidden from the eyes of our congregation, attempting to behold God in the individual providences of an ordinary human being. And then later on 213, I think in a way this might sum up this thread. He says, you say, after all, you are an unknown person in an unknown place who will seem irrelevant to most people in the world today, not to mention those who will read about your life centuries from now. And yet God gathers up every detail of your days with love and interest. Do you think pastors have a greatness complex, an ambition complex that we've got to confront head on?
I do. Certainly because of our own heart, you know, our own soul, you know, we certainly, there's that. Any of us can, all of us are tempted, no different than those disciples, to say, you know, I want to be at your right hand and I want to be at your left, and I want to be great. But I think also the conditions of American culture, at least, we're constantly pressured to do large, famous things as fast as possible. And that puts us in a position of market share and competition. And so those, we're judged as success on the basis of large, famous, and immediate. And because of that, you add that with the already temptation we have in our being, it just creates a perfect storm of misguided ambition.
Mm. Well, and that, you know, and you've alluded to it already, this is tied in very much with this theme of our humanity mm-hmm. in the book. You say that greatness, even in ministry, cannot escape humanity. And I really appreciated when you shared that insight about when you were, I think, examined for ordination, being asked about the days in Genesis, but not really been asked about how that actually impacted your ministry mm-hmm. as an embodied human being.
Yeah.
And that, and I believe that kind of paves the way for some of the things you say in the book about the need for slowing down mm-hmm. and having patience. Do you think technology, as it, in its modern forms, do you think that's kind of the root of all that, or is there something else really going on that's fostered that kind of this kind of problem that we're having?
Well, yes, to all that. Certainly, we're blessed by technology. You're reading a book. You know, we're recording. Mm-hmm. I'm thankful, you know, for that. But the underlying convictions that we have as a consumer celebrity culture. So we're consumer oriented. I'm not even meaning that as a grumpy person. I'm not even critiquing it at the moment. Just acknowledging I've grown up in a consumer culture, which means I've been apprenticed in an environment of immediate gratification. And so if I don't get a text back or an email back within a certain time frame, I think something's wrong. And then a celebrity orientation where you have to somehow stand out above others and be known. I think those two things drive technology in a way that's not good for us. And so it can give the illusion. I can give the illusion because I've read a book and I tweet, you know, on a Twitter feed. It can give the illusion that I'm somehow somebody. Mm. But actually, you and I are just sitting on my couch, and my dog is right here, Nala. You know, she sneezed a little earlier, and we're just sitting here in my house, and we actually can only be one place at one time. And we're actually just the people that we are. And uh, to to try to come to terms with that matters a lot. Mm. So haste, I think our culture, amid everything that's good about it, we value haste. And the Bible makes very plain that haste is associated with folly.
That's true. And you mentioned, you give several references to patience in the New Testament and the pastoral epistles, as I recall, and it's amazing how many references there actually are there to doing our work and doing it with all patience, as the phrase goes in most English Bibles. This, again, coalesces with another theme in the book about the importance of our attentiveness to our place. And we're here in Webster Groves. This is your place. And what it means for you to know this place, desire this place, to see it as God, see it as part of God's care for you and having placed you here and not somewhere else. I don't want to beat up on anybody out there, but do you think, again, our sort of evangelical conference culture a little bit, and the way it kind of sort of democratizes everything, it sort of puts everything out there and everyone gets to input into things and everyone gets to hear what's going on everywhere else. Do you think that kind of militates against us being embedded in our place that God's called us to serve and focusing on our little towns and our little communities?
Well, that's a good question. You know, upward mobility, so we're consumer-oriented, we're celebrity-minded, we value immediate gratification, and we're upwardly mobile. If particularly if we're in a white-collar subculture of America, so we're groomed with this mindset that I'm here in order to get somewhere else. And so you go to, you know, you go to kindergarten to get to elementary school. You go to elementary school to get to junior high. Junior high to get to high school. You get to high school to get your first job. Your first job, you know, in order to get to the next one. Or you go to college in order to leave there to get your first job. Or to go on to other school. Anyway, we're trained in how to leave and start something new. But very few of us have been trained, at least in a white-collar subculture, very few of us have been trained to know what to do once we get there. Because eventually you get where you're going.
Presumably.
Yeah. And so the skill set to start something is different than a skill set to stay with something. You know, to stay with something, you have to learn how to deal with boredom. You have to have a theology of boredom. How does Jesus apprentice us with boredom? And are we bored with things that bore him? Or are we bored with things that he's excited about? You know? And so if I'm in Webster Groves, Missouri, I have to ask him, Lord, why do you love this place? It sure would seems more beneficial or influential if I was somewhere more strategic, positioned in order to leverage a platform to reach the most amount of people with the least amount of effort. And right there, we're looking at productivity and efficiency. And the Lord does call certain people to do that, and they need our prayer and our help because there are minefields that they have to face that others of us don't. But in my case, I'm not there. I'm here. And so the Lord is here. He preceded me. What is it that he loves about this place? Well, the trees were created through him, the grass, the squirrels, the rabbits, the owl that I hear out at night. You know, the people who are here were created through him, in him, for him, right? And so he is not bored with Webster Groves. Why am I bored with Webster? So I need his help. I was hearing someone recently say, you know, what are you going to do with your life? Are you going to you're gonna have a great mission for God, or are you going to go out onto the seashore and look at seashells? And I was thinking, I think that's a false dichotomy. I get what's trying to be said there, but God created that sea and the seashore and the shells. All creation declares his glory. You know, Christian theology calls that general revelation. So for me to care about a seashell and to notice it is one aspect of my mission. If mission has a place, and we're body and soul creatures, and our bodies as well as our souls will be redeemed, then to care about a seashell isn't a waste of time. It's an act of glorifying the one who created the shell in the first place. Now, the kind of thing we're talking about is assumed in the wisdom literature of the Bible. Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, the Psalms, Job. But a lot of us are not familiar with that.
In an agrarian society, in other words, it comes more natural to pay attention to the particularities of a place.
Yes.
Not just sort of the natural world, as it were, although that's part of it, but just the individual, ordinary people that we serve, who no one will ever hear about. They'll never be the feature on a magazine, a news story or anything like that. Is that kind of where this goes practically?
Yeah. So like this morning before we met, I've met with four people in our church, and I've written correspondences to two folks that I met with yesterday. I've prayed for them in my imperfect way, and I've sat with them. Well, no one in the world knows who they are. So if I want to become more famous, which means I need to go somewhere else to have more influence, somebody has to come be the pastor of these people I met with. Somebody does, 'cause the Lord loves them. And so even the famous person, whoever that is out there, there, I trust, meeting with people today that I've never heard of. And so pastoral work is such a local, particular thing. Even if whether it's a large number of people or a small number of people, the questions are the same. Will I love my neighbor as myself? Will I love my enemy? Will I do that out of love for God? Will I be faithful to the gospel in this place, among this people? You know, I think that's why the governing images in the Bible for pastoral work and life are a marathon runner, a hardworking farmer, a soldier, and the time, postures in the Bible are agrarian. You know, there's a season for everything, you know. Even the order of creation with work and rest.
Mm-hmm.
Work and rest, you know. Work and rest, work and rest, work and rest, work and rest. And then it's rest, rest.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you say a lot about the shepherd, obviously, in the book as well, which is far from glamorous and very particular.
Yeah, he's a returning one. So, you know, in Ephesians 4, with those gift sets, there's apostles and prophets, evangelists, pastor teachers. So, you know, one of these things is not like the other. It's an old Sesame Street song. Apostle, evangelist, and prophet, those are itinerant ministry-oriented gifts. The shepherd, you know, the pastor teacher, the shepherd teacher, that's the returning one. That gift set has to return to the same old hillside with the same old sheep, you know, the same old place. And so that's a very different set of skills that a pastor has to surrender to with Jesus. That's why I call it an apprenticeship. We have to learn to surrender to the rhythms of a day among a people and the providences and the stories and the creation in a locality and follow him into it.
Well, there's a few things that you mentioned near the end of the book that I think are should bear mentioning as well. You talk about three different omni temptations that we have. One is the posture of the expert. In other words, the pastor as knowing it all. The other is the fixer. We can fix everything. It's the power to solve. And then also the issue of accessibility. So being everywhere for everyone at all times. Now, I was thinking about those, and certainly I think probably we all experience those at different times. Do you think those are driven more by church context and church history, or do you think that's more about a personal history? So, in other words, if I've got a history as a feeling like I'm always rescuing things, that might shape my inclination to fall prey to that temptation. But, of course, the church's heritage and their expectations play into that. Do you think it's just a combination of those two, or is it one more of a personal history thing that makes us fall prey to one of those? Or is it more of the church context? What do you think the driver in that is?
Both. I think it's both. Yeah, so, you know, those three temptations are basically found in the Garden of Eden. You know, you'll be like God, knowing. good and evil, and you won't die. And so this desire to be like God is already in us. And then we have providence in our life, the personal circumstances of our own life story that influence that. If you hang around with an angry man, you learn his ways, the Proverbs tells us. So we're apprenticed without realizing it. We're mentored in ways of being by the people that we're with, and so we may have been in a situation in which we are the one expected to fix it or to know it. Maybe we had to do that in order to remain safe or loved, whatever it is, in those local settings of folly and wisdom in which we grew up. But then you bring all that into a culture, a local culture of a church, and they individually and collectively all have their own histories with trying to be like God and the various ways through the ministers and leaders they've had previously that's all worked itself out. And so all that merges together for a pretty spicy soup, you know, and but a Jesus saturated Jesus beholding way of being together can overcome a lot of that.
Mm. You mentioned in the book that, and this is just kind of helping us think toward a practical horizon as we go forward, you allude to Jeremiah and the exile and how the promises that were extended to a people of a future return from exile, that was something that most of them, perhaps none of them actually, given probably what the life expectancies were under the circumstances, they would not realize and see the promise. And that got me to thinking that that's true of a lot of the things in the scriptures. The promise of the Hebrews coming out of Egyptian bondage, it took so much time for that to actually happen, to be a part of that generation that came out. And indeed, all the prophets who looked for the Messiah, they waited, they looked. Our Messiah has come, but we still wait for his second coming. You put not so fine a point on this at the bottom of 97, and I'll just share this as a way of kind of concluding. You say there is nothing we can do in ministry that does not require God to act if true fruit is to be produced. Everything pastors hope will take place in a person's life with God remains outside the pastor's own power. So as we kind of wrap this up and think about this idea of looking forward and learning to play the long game, what are two or three of some of the key things that we need to be keeping in mind if we're going to have this long-term vision of fruit for the Lord, if we're going to have this patience, even in our limitations that you talk about? What are just a couple of things that come to mind that are key for us?
Oh, that's good. One, to remember that we're creatures as well as Christians. We're human beings. You know, Francis Schaeffer said we have a double bow. We bow before the Lord as his creatures. We bow before him as Christians, you know, saved in Christ. And that as a ministry leader, I'm still a human being. The way I try to say it in this book is, you know, if the Lord granted, if you were preaching this coming Sunday and an unusual effusion of his power came and there was extended repentance, extended taking hold of the promises of Christ, a season of revival and things like this, someone would still have to go to the bathroom eventually, you know. And that's true of you and me. We're human beings. So part of being able to go the long haul in a place is being human in the place. I'm not just a pastor. My name is Zach, you know. I'm Zach, son of Vern, you know, to use the New Testament language, Simon, son of John, you know. And I come from Henryville, Indiana, and so if you enjoy French silk pie and you get it free at a local restaurant for some giveaway, you get to enjoy that as a human being, you know. So along with enjoying French silk pie and just being able to enjoy, as a human being is meant to, the good things God created. You know, the Bible says that. There's nothing better. As a matter of fact, Ecclesiastes repeats that several times. There's nothing better than for a person to enjoy their lot, their food, their drink, the wife of their youth, if they're married, you know. So I don't try to practice that because I'm a pastor and I'm supposed to. I just get to be a follower of Jesus who, in a place. So that's a mindset that we need help with. And the second thing is rhythms of pause and rest. And so I talk about this in the book about the four portions of a day. And so anyway, there's, you know, four pauses during a day, morning, afternoon, evening, and night watches from the scripture. And there's one day a week, you know, and 1 week a quarter, and 1 quarter every 7 years, you know, something like that. You know, we need rhythms of pace. We need a marathon pace rather than a sprint. And then finally, the third thing we need is we'll need to learn the wisdom of being quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to vent our anger. That's not referring to those who don't like to talk. There's a passive way that we're quiet, and it sounds wise, but we're not being wise. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about being able to handle negative emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So that James passage of being quick to speak, quick to listen, slow to speak, even if what we were going to say is right, that means we're not saying the first thing that comes to our mind. We're not saying everything that comes to our mind.
Mm-hmm.
And not to vent anger. Even the strongest emotion in us doesn't just get to be there. So what do we do with the things we're thinking and the things we're feeling while we're listening?
Mm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the next thing it says is to discern with meekness, right, the word that's implanted in you, that community. To sort out those things which are unrighteous, and then to be doers of the word. So there's a process there that we have to learn as a community and individually to handle what we think and feel, sifting it out, letting go of that which isn't according to his word, holding on to that which is, and then living accordingly, responding accordingly. So all that is to say is we need help handling negative emotions,
right,
if we're going to stay in one place for a while.
Right, because there's going to be a great fluctuation over time.
Yeah.
I mean, moment to moment, in fact.
That's right. Know. Yeah, so 1 week might be great, another week might be really tough. And if you're in a place for a while, that means you, depending on how the size of the place, like in this place where I am, I see folks that left our church, I'll see them at the grocery store.
Oh, right, yeah.
Or there's mutual friends in the community. Some, you know, my wife and I are invited to a gathering, and there are folks there who left our church, you know.
Yeah.
So there's learning how to deal with things like not just boredom, but things like pain. Learning gratitude for small things. Learning to delight and not be bored. You know, sometimes I'm bored with things that do not bore the Lord. And so coming to terms with that. So there's these, embracing our humanity, rhythms of rest, handling negative emotions, and finally learning to be excited about what excites the Lord. And sometimes that is a flower or a particular person's story in a local place that he's thrilled by.
Yeah,
you know, and coming to see that,
right,
and so the world doesn't remember such a person, but the Lord does.
Mm. Well, I'm honored to have had the time with you today, both over lunch and here in your home and the normal rhythms of your life here. I appreciate you sharing that with me and our many readers and listeners who will benefit greatly from this interview, and then I think your book as well. They'll pick that up.
Thank you.